Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is AB Dawji and this is, of course, The Big Picture. The program in which we go beyond and behind the headlines of the mainstream media. Well, here we are, the glorious month of Ramadan. How's it going so far, hey? Sure, some of you look like your batteries are a bit flat. Yes, I'm actually afraid to say anything funny in case some of you grumpies get irritated. Anyway, it's been an exciting few days, eh? Exciting few days. The voting roller coaster ride. The election chakkar. Lots of talk about who is going to lose support, who is going to get more, and so on. Who to vote for, or whether to vote or not. So many viewpoints, and so many viewpoints. And so, there I was in Brickfield Road, and outside his shop was Mahmud Bhai, Mahmud Mota, I call him, sitting there having his tea and Mari biscuit. Shame, eh? Shame. Poor man is suffering from a terrible medical condition known as Ramadan ulcers. Can't fast. So I stopped to chat with him. He said in his big, booming voice, "Dawji, all this election thing is nonsense. Waste of time." I was curious, so I asked him, "Why do you say that, Mota?" And he answered, "Because you know what? The white people was running this country for a long time and made a hell of a mess of it. Then the African people took over and for 25 years they made a mess of it. I think now they must let the Indians run the country and see how it goes. Give us a chance. What do you think, Dawji?" I must admit that this unexpected political formula made me a bit dizzy. And when I came to my senses, I said, "Mota, but the Indians have been running the country for the past 10 years. Don't you remember the Guptas?" He let out a loud laugh. Hey, Dawji, you're right, eh? Maybe now we should give the coloreds a chance." And we both laughed loudly, and I left him with his Mari biscuits. Anyway, how's it, my Chinas? You know, I didn't speak to you for 2 weeks. Yes, that's right. I was in China with my group of 70 people. Now, let me admit at the outset that I was quite unaware of exactly how much China has developed. Yes, of course, I know that its economy was streaking ahead, galloping ahead. But I thought that with more than 1.5 billion people, it would be, well, crowded, maybe a bit dusty place with the infrastructure falling apart, the roads, etc., in poor condition. I imagine it to be something like India or Cairo. So, was I in for a big shock? The cities were huge, with massive modern skyscrapers. The streets were wide and full of traffic, but all moving in an orderly fashion. Not rough and tumble like in the Middle East. Whoa! Go to Jordan or Egypt, cars are just going all over the place. And of course, talking about cars, I expected mainly Chinese cars, like what you see here. No siree. BMs, Mercs, and occasional Lambo, many Porsches, Toyotas, Fords, Volvos, every possible make. But the most impressive was the cleanliness of the cities, the towns, and the villages. That really surprised me. Spotless, in the busiest part of town. Not a scrap of paper. Go into Durban Central at 5 p.m. and you will see rubbish all over the place. And efficiency was another thing that impressed me. Everything functioned smoothly and on time. Planes, trains. And speaking about trains, we took a bullet train that traveled at 310 kilometers an hour. Well, you know what? I thought that today I will be all profound and eloquent in painting a fascinating picture of China. But alas, dear listeners, words escape me at this time. I shouldn't have had that last pasta square last night. It's any time. It's still sitting on my chest. Anyway, a poet laureate, Harrison Ford, also known as Richard Gere, but whose real name is, and he was in our group, Shah Nawaz Khan, was inspired to paint a picture of our journey behind the bamboo curtain. Listen to this. Here is the poem from Shah Nawaz Khan. Awake, O slumbering dragon, reveal to us the powerful dynasties of the past, the tales of the brave warriors that stand guard until the end of time, the great wall that kept your enemies out, your mythical creatures that guard your emperor's tombs. O slumbering dragon, reveal to us the language born from burnt bones, the elements that shape your character, the fiber of the past, a silk thread linking east to west. O slumbering dragon, reveal to us the beauty of your forbidden city, your temples of worship that lead to heaven, your minarets like flowers scattered in the countryside, a square that millions of followers pay homage to. O dragon, now that you are awake, we see the scars of your battles overshadowed by temples of buildings lighting up the night skies, your great wall unguarded, replaced by bridges of splendor, optic fiber, the new silk, connecting people so well. But why, oh why, is there no twinkle in the sky, oh China? Wow. There you are, folks. Shah Nawaz Khan, poet laureate. Let's have a round of applause for Shah Nawaz. No doubt a candidate for the Pulitzer Prize. I couldn't have said it better myself. He covered it all. Yes, we went to the Great Wall of China, one of the wonders of the world. Absolutely fascinating. Then there was the mystical terracotta warriors, another amazing array of 8,000 lifelike statues guarding a tomb. And of course, we had to go to Tiananmen Square and then to the Forbidden City. I can tell you so much about these sites. But wait, what was he saying about minarets? Dear listeners, let me pause and where was I now? Let me just pause a while and tell you about a certain expectation that I had before I went to China. An assumption. That's what it is, an assumption. You know, with all the recent media reports I thought that the Muslims right across China, the whole of China, were being persecuted. Total repression throughout China. Well, was I in for a big surprise. Big surprise. We took a bullet train from Beijing to Xi'an. That's about 5 hours. The ancient capital of China. And the starting point of the Silk Road. In the Muslim quarter of Xi'an, we visited the Xi'an Grand Mosque, as it is known. I must confess that I was blown away by this amazing structure and the buildings in the courtyard. All the architecture was in the Chinese style, not the design that we are familiar with, that is the Arab style. No, it was like the pagodas. The great mosque was built in 1742, and there are 7 ancient masajid in the area, serving a population of 60,000 Muslims. 60,000. What a beautiful and serene environment and atmosphere. And in the whole Muslim quarter, you find a seemingly endless labyrinth of street food, restaurants, and bustling street life. Good heavens, where was the repression? I thought, and what I was hearing about. Of course, we will discuss this later on. Oh yes, I just mentioned to you about food. Now, let me ask you this. What comes to mind when you hear China and food? Snakes, worms, iguanas, and other assorted khokhas. Well, let me say this. We didn't starve. We ate at halal Indian restaurants. Butter chicken, chicken tikka, dal fry. And of course, we also ate at halal Chinese places. Not really my cup of tea, but the people were guzzling the chow, noodles being the central dish. Right, let's see where next from Xi'an. And I'm trying to focus on the Muslim places now. Much to say about all the other sites, but I want to focus on them. Well, from Xi'an, we went to Lingxia, a distance of around 260 kilometers. We went by coach. Let me tell you what knocked me out. All along the way, we passed village after village, and in each of them, we saw towering minarets. Incredible. Even the smallest dhoti had a masjid. One fellow counted over 100 masajid by the time we reached Lingxia. That's how many villages we passed. More than 100. Next stop, well, let me just tell you a little bit about Lingxia. Lingxia has been one of the main religious, cultural, and commercial centers of China's Muslim community, earning itself the nickname the Little Mecca of China. Almost every major Islamic movement in China finds its origin amongst Muslims who came to Lingxia disseminating new doctrines after pilgrimage to Mecca. It remains the main center of China's Qadiriyya and Kufiya Sufi orders. It was also the home of Ma Mingjin, the founder of the Jahriya order. Upon arrival in Lingxia, we visited the Muslim community, madrasa, local bazaar, kufiya, huashi masjid, and Gongbai, Qadiriyya great Gongbai in the Muslim city of Lingxia. Right. There you are. And I said I'm focusing on the Islamic aspect of our journey. Next stop, Langzhou. Many sights to see there. Many sights to see there. We made Salah at the Jingwan Masjid, which was recently renovated in the Arab style. The next stop, Guangzhou. Lots of sights there. Lots of sights. Salah at the Haisheng Masjid, one of the earliest masajids constructed when Islam came to China in the 5th century. Of course, Guangzhou is a shopper's paradise. People were running and filling suitcases. It's a main place for shopping in China. As I said, we saw many sights. But I am emphasizing the Islamic aspect to show that Muslims are seemingly free to practice Islam, except for one area which we will get to shortly, inshallah. And still in Guangzhou, let me read from the itinerary. We will then visit the Muslim sage's tomb. That means a top Muslim personality. And this place looks like an ancient Chinese temple with walls surrounding its four corners. History recorded that Nabi Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, at the age of 57, sent his uncle Sa'ad ibn Abi Waqas to Guangzhou. The Muslim sage's tomb was to commemorate Sa'ad ibn Abi Waqas, who died in Guangzhou. That, for many of us, was the highlight. Imagine visiting a masjid built 1,300 years ago. Mind-blowing, I tell you, mind-blowing. Especially its architectural design in the Chinese style. Something to see. So, at last, let's get to the point. As I said in the beginning, I was somewhat apprehensive about visiting China. News reports indicate that there is a heavy clampdown on Muslims, a vicious repression, an attack on everything representing Islam. This is what I thought of China, that the whole of China is in this state, or the Muslims are suffering in this state. But the picture we saw was very far from this. How come? How come? Well, the answer is that the news reports focus on what's happening in a certain part of China, a very large province in the northwest known as Xinjiang, where a certain Muslim group lives, known as the Uyghurs. So why is there a clampdown on them? Well, to unpack all of this for us, we will be having shortly on the line Dr. Ashraf Dokrat, or should I call him Maulana Ashraf Dokrat. We will have him unpacking the whole issue after this break, inshallah. Yes, welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. And before the break, we were discussing a very important subject, the oppression of the Muslims in China. What's it all about? And to unpack all of this for us, we have on the line Maulana Ashraf Dokrat. And I can also call him by another designation, Dr. Ashraf Dokrat. Maulana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. How are you, Abu Bakr Bhai?
Alhamdulillah, everything is wonderful. For those who don't know who is Dr. Maulana Ashraf Dokrat, can you give us a two-line CV, please?
Maulana, I'm a teacher, a mudarris, a teacher at a madrasa in Pretoria, two madrasas in Pretoria and one Darul Uloom in Johannesburg.
Right, and where did the title doctor come from?
Molana, I completed my PhD and I did studies on at university, so that is where the doctor comes from. I don't prescribe, I don't give out any drugs.
And I believe you lectured at the university also.
Yes, I'm still attached to Center for Languages at the University of Johannesburg, and I spent 17 years as a teacher as a lecturer at the University of Johannesburg. That time it was the Rayan Afrikaans University.
Alhamdulillah, well done, sir, well done. Right, let's get to the issue. What's happening in Xinjiang? What's happening to the Uyghurs that we hear about?
Okay, this is Uyghur. You've pronounced it very well. It's we must remember, we read it as U-I-G-H-U-R or U-Y-G-H-U-R, but we say Uyghur. So that is the correct pronunciation. Who are they? They are a member of a Turkic people of northwest China. And like you mentioned, they found in this region called Xinjiang and adjoining areas as well. They consist about 20 million Muslims, and they belong to 10 distinct ethnicities in China. And the Hui, that's H-U-I, are the largest ethnic Muslim majority. The Uyghurs are the second largest ethnic Muslim group. And the Hui Muslims, H-U-I Muslims, are ethnically, they are closer to the hegemonic Han Chinese ethnic majority. Whereas the Uyghurs are ethnically, they are Turkic people, they speak a Turkic language, and they are mainly Sunni Muslims. They originate from an area that they come from Central and East Asia. According to, as of 2019, the Uyghurs live mainly in this Xinjiang area called the Uyghur Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China. And as we said, they are one of China's 55 officially recognized ethnic minorities. In Xinjiang, this area, Xinjiang, actually borders Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and has a population of 20 million people. There are remote mountainous regions. There are deserts. The Taklimakan Desert is there, and also this very arid Tarim Basin. So in Xinjiang, we have 10 million Uyghurs who live there, and it is an autonomous area. And since 1949, it has been part of the People's Republic of China. The region intermittently has asked and demanded autonomy. But what is known is that Xinjiang came under Chinese rule as far back as the 18th century. The East Turkestan state was briefly declared in 1949, but this independence was short-lived, and later on Xinjiang then became officially part of Communist China. In the 1990s, and this is significant, open support for the separatist groups increased after the collapse of Soviet Union and the emergence of independent Muslim states in Central Asia. In the early part of the 20th century, the Uyghurs briefly declared independence as East Turkmenistan. Now, this region, however, was invaded by China and brought under complete control of the Communist Chinese in 1949. Since then, this Uyghur Xinjiang region where the Uyghurs live has been officially recognized, just like Tibet to its south, as an autonomous region within China. And their struggle is very similar to the Buddhist people of Tibet. They try to maintain their culture, their language, their religion under the dominant Chinese rule. And their struggle is one really to preserve their ethno-religious identity. In 2019, it will be 70 years since the Chinese government first occupied the Uyghur land. And over the years, Chinese government policies have gradually curtailed the Uyghur religion, their commercial and the cultural activities. And what they have tried to do is assimilate them into the hegemonic Chinese Han culture. So what we have is mass immigration of Han Chinese into Xinjiang. Uyghurs have become a minority in their own place. And following the war on terrorism of September 2001, the attacks of the Chinese government has intensified, and its policy of cleansing the Uyghur culture and religion and incorporating these people under the dominant Han Chinese cultural identity has increased. So Beijing has suppressed any sort of demonstration and suppressed any activists. These activists have therefore gone underground. And this is a very complex situation, but many say ethnic tensions are also caused by economic and cultural factors, which are the root of the recent violence. And major development projects have been brought prosperity to Xinjiang's big cities. And this has attracted also a number of young and technically qualified Han Chinese. So the Han Chinese are given the best jobs, and the majority do well economically. This fuels then a resentment among the Uyghurs. And Uyghur cultural and commercial activities have been curtailed by the Chinese state. There are complaints of severe restriction on Islam, fewer mosques, the destruction of mosques. We've seen some historical mosques, beautiful mosques, built hundreds of years ago that have been destroyed. There is strict control over the religious schools. And as a result of this, there has been some sort of resistance. There was the 2009 uprising in Xinjiang, which led to over 150 deaths. In 2013, there was the attack on Tiananmen Square in Beijing, for which East Turkmenistan Islamic Movement claimed responsibility. And then in 2014, the Kunming attack, which killed 29 civilians. In response to this, the Chinese government have been brutal and calculated. The Beijing government are accused of exaggerating the threat from the Uyghur separatists to justify their long-standing policy of ethno-religious cleansing. Over the past decade, many prominent Uyghurs have been killed, incarcerated, or they have sought asylum abroad after being accused of terrorism. Maulana, if we go to the Haram and we go to Mecca or Medina, if you look at the side in the old section, we see some old Chinese people-looking people, often, you know, sitting on the side, some of them collecting sadaqa, whatever people give them. These and that typical features are actually the Uyghur Muslims. So what is also happening now is that their women are forcibly married to we Chinese in order to erase their genetic and ethnic identity. One of the more inhuman developments during the past few years has been the use of internment camps that have been euphemistically called re-education centers by the Chinese state. Khalid Baidoun, an associate professor of law and Al Jazeera correspondent, described these so-called re-education camps when he said that within these overpopulated camps, state agents are commissioned to heal the illness. Islam is regarded as an illness through a litany of horrors, including forcing Uyghur Muslims to eat pork and to drink alcohol. They are required to memorize and recite Communist Party songs. They are forced into grueling work and enrolled in Mandarin language courses and comprehensive training devised to extract their religion and culture out of them. He goes further to say that they are locked up, they are uprooted far from their home and the family. And 10 to 20% of Uyghur Muslim population in Xinjiang are currently experienced or have experienced the horrors of the largest network of internment camps since World War II. Those who resist the wild inside are tortured, and reports of death from family members and outright disappearance are widely documented. The majority of those who are interned have been men, and the Chinese authority have supplemented the disproportionate incarceration of men with a policy of forcing Uyghur women, Muslim women, to marry non-Muslim Han men, further diluting the Uyghur Muslim population and entrenching this Uyghur hegemony. One of the most sinister and callous developments under the presidency of Xi Jinping since 2013 has been the use of what he called home occupiers to monitor and report on Uyghur families. So what happens is that a person from the Han ethnic majority are mobilized then to aid the military and the police in their campaigns of so-called re-education. So what they do is they come in and occupy the homes of the Uyghurs as observers. They claim that they are observing and they present themselves as relatives. Their chief goal is to watch the villagers, take notes, and assess the Uyghurs' level of loyalty to their country. They note, for example, how well they spoke Chinese. They stay at alert for signs of their attachment to Islam that might be so-called extreme. This is the way they test for the attachment to Islam. So if a Uyghur host owns a copy of the Quran, if he prays on a Friday, if he fasts during the month of Ramadan, if he does not eat pork or he doesn't drink wine, or simply he greets a neighbor in Arabic with Assalamu Alaikum, then all of this can be used as evidence of an extreme attachment to Islam. And based on such evidence, the Han relatives then recommend that the host should be sent away to these so-called re-education camps. These centers, these re-education schools, are like rehabilitation centers for drug users. In this case, the Uyghur cultural and religious identity and practice is a disease that has to be cured. So Uyghurs who are deemed to be adhering to even the remotest Islamic belief or practice are regarded as in need of rehabilitation. As far as the United Nations is concerned, their experts have recently called for China to shut down these political re-education camps. They've asked them to respond, and the Chinese say that we are actually countering terrorism. In 2018, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation also expressed their concern. And in 2019, we have renewed calls for this from the United Nations and also from the Pentagon. It is interesting to note that Turkey has also supported the Uyghur Muslims. Iran has not supported the Uyghur Muslims. They have supported the Chinese. And as South Africans, we must remember that Chinese economic and political clout is very strong, and the South African government often succumbed to that. Remember that they refused to grant a visa to the Buddhist Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, on three separate occasions. The Dalai Lama has openly declared his desire for Tibetans to maintain their culture, language, and religion under Chinese rule. Amnesty International, in their report published as far as 2013 already has said that what they label illegal religious and separate activities were clamped down on peaceful expressions of cultural identity, and they complained that the world turns a blind eye. Since 2014, some Xinjiang government departments have banned Muslim civil servants from fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. So this is not the first time that China has restricted fasting in Xinjiang, but it followed a slew of attacks on the public attributed to Uyghur extremists, prompting concerns that the ban will increase tension. These re-education camps seem to be here to stay, and the Chinese respond by saying that, look, these are actually camps where we're training and we're offering vocational training so that the Uyghurs can be up to date. But this is actually not so, because in October 2018, the BBC released the details of an extensive investigation into China's hidden concentration camps and their attempt to correct the thought of these people, and the findings were quite horrific. This is a cultural genocide, they said. These are akin to concentration camps, in fact. In December 2018, Radio Free Asia reported that Chinese authorities arrested a senior court official from among the ethnic Uyghurs called Khalid Qurban. And they did this just because he expressed concern over the mass incarceration of members. Qurban was the deputy head of the Intermediate People's Court in China, and he said that he was distressed by the vast number of Uyghurs and other Muslim ethnic minorities who had been detained in political re-education camps since 2017 because they are just simply accused of harboring strong religious views and politically incorrect ideas. Qurban was then called into multiple chats with officials from the State Security Department after speaking out against this policy. And Uyghur senior court officials have to sign off on sentences issued in some cases concerning crimes of terrorism and religious extremism in Xinjiang. And Qurban may have believed that he might later be judged to have been a party to the crimes against humanity. And he was hesitant as far as this is concerned. He was then arrested and taken into custody. So this is the current situation, a very, very sad situation that we find our brothers and sisters in this area facing, Babakala.
Indeed, a very sad situation. And what has been the response of other Muslim countries, for example, Saudi Arabia and its Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman?
No, there we find, in fact, you know, he is supportive of the Chinese. He sees them as trying to curb religious extremism and terrorism. You know, it is surprising that he's saying that, but Mike Pompeo has criticized Iran because of their refusal to condemn the Chinese Muslims. So this type of situation we have all the time. Saudi Arabia says that China has the right to carry out anti-terrorism and de-extremization work for its national security. This is said in February 2019. So we have the Turkish who that denounced this. The Turkish said violating the fundamental human rights of Uyghur Turks and other Muslim communities in Xinjiang autonomous region should be denounced. And the Turkish came out strong against this. The international media, many people who from the international media have approached the Chinese itself. The Chinese say that their foreign ministry say we have not heard of this situation. They say they're actually doing a favor to the Uyghurs. They've asked the world to be extremely cautious of China's, you know, propaganda against China. So, this is the type of responses that we've had regarding this.
Well, there you are, folks, an excellent analysis.
As South Africans, certainly we can highlight this, we can bring it to the attention of our government, certainly. That's the least that we can do. Show solidarity with the Uyghur Muslims, call on the South African government to use their newly acquired status as a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council effectively, and call on to the Chinese government to abandon these so-called re-education camp and the programs to persecute the Uyghur Muslims. The South African UN representatives should lobby other countries also to put pressure on China to end the ethno-religious cleansing of Uyghurs.
Indeed. Well, as I said, an excellent analysis by Dr. Maulana Ashraf Dokrat about the situation of Muslims, the Uyghurs in the province of Xinjiang. Maulana, jazakallah for giving us your time and your excellent perspective of that situation. Very sad indeed, yes.
A pleasure. Jazakumullah, salam jaza, and please do remember us in your du'as.
Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Right, we don't have much time left now, and let's change gears a little bit. You know, just before Ramadan, I was watching a documentary on Al Jazeera. It made me so angry. My blood pressure shot up. After a while, I couldn't take it anymore, and I switched it off. The documentary is called The Occupation of the American Mind. It's an 84-minute documentary, and you can watch it for free on YouTube, on your cell phone or your computer. Just search in Google, Occupation of the American Mind. Here's what the YouTube write-up says. Over the past few years, Israel's ongoing military occupation of Palestinian territory and repeated invasions of the Gaza Strip have triggered a fierce backlash against Israeli policies virtually everywhere in the world except the United States. The occupation of the American mind takes an eye-opening look at this critical exception, zeroing in on pro-Israeli public relations efforts within the United States. Narrated by Roger Waters and featuring leading observers of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and U.S. media culture, the film explores how the Israeli government, the United States government, and the pro-Israel lobby have joined forces, often with very different motives, to shape American media coverage of the conflict in Israel's favor. From the U.S.-based public relations campaigns that emerged in the 1980s to today, the film provides a sweeping analysis of Israel's decades-long battle for the hearts, minds, and tax dollars of the American people in the face of widening international condemnation of its increasingly right-wing policies. Narrated by Roger Waters and featuring Amina Haas, M.J. Rosenberg, Stephen M. Walt, Noam Chomsky, Rula Jibril, Henry Sigman, Richard Khalidi, Rami Khoury, Yusuf Manea, Norman Finkelstein, Max Blumenthal, Phyllis Bennis, Norman Solomon, Mark Crispin Miller, Peter Hart, and Sud Jali. These are all very prominent and outspoken critics of Israel. So, basically what it's all about is that it shows how the American public is fed a one-sided pro-Israel view of what's happening in the so-called Palestine-Israeli conflict. Therefore, one may classify this as propaganda, right? This feeding of one-sided information is clearly propaganda. And propaganda means a false narrative, and even more clear, it means lies. Yes, lies. Israel is depicted as the victim and Palestinians as the aggressors. I like the title. The Zionists? Well, as you know, the Zionists came and smashed the Palestinians and occupied their lands. And Israel and its supporters have occupied the minds of the American people. They are captured. Isn't it amazing? The mighty United States, regarded as the most advanced country in the world, yet it is captured by such propaganda. And the truth is out there for all to see. There is no doubt at all that the Palestinians are oppressed people, that Israel is a racist state in that it harshly discriminates against non-Jews. That's so blatantly clear. Right, and what's clear is that it deals harshly with the Palestinians, shooting off arms and legs of young people, demolishing homes, keeping people in jail without trial. You know the story. And still people who know about peace and justice and compassion and human values, they turn a blind eye to Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. How is that possible in this day and age? I saw the bombings of Gaza. Israel says that Hamas started it by firing rockets. Yes, yes, yes. But missing from this is context. Israel has been throttling Gaza for so long. The place is devastated, an open prison, a nightmare. And Israel has one policy. We will oppress you in any way that we want to, and you will not respond. And if you did respond, we will smash you in the harshest possible way. It's called disproportionate force. I've run out of time. I was going to tell you a bit more, but let me end off with some light at the end of the tunnel. Right. Selvin, he's a cashier at my local supermarket, and he was looking very distressed. I asked him what was wrong, and he said, "Hey, boss, what I must tell you? I'm not feeling too well. Last night I was dreaming that I was eating a giant marshmallow. When I woke up this morning, my pillow was gone." Okay, one last one. We got about a minute left. This was the advice written on the tombstone of a man in Bombay. Look for a woman who can cook well. Look for a woman who can keep your house neat and clean. Look for a woman who doesn't argue with you. Look for a woman who is very passionate. But look out that the four women don't meet, or you will lie here dead like me. Sister Sabi Dawji, bidding you all, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.